Thank you. I'm Carrie Ann Lucas, bar number 36620. I represent the mother, Ms. A.L.H. in this case. I am substitute counsel for the trial counsel in this matter. I am sharing my time with Ms. Gookin, whose bar number is 41197, who's counsel for the father, Mr. B.P.W. She's also a substitute for trial counsel, and we would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You should watch that.
Thank you. We're here before you to discuss the issues, all of the issues. We're here before you on all of the issues we submitted, but primarily we're here to discuss two of the issues with you today, the constitutionality of Rule 4.3 and the issue of less drastic alternatives as an alternative to termination. And Ms. Gookin will address less drastic alternatives. The standard of review for equal protection challenges is, as the Colorado Supreme Court found in Romer v. Evans, strict scrutiny when an action impacts a fundamental right. Here, state termination of parental rights is an infringement upon a fundamental right. As such, strict scrutiny should apply. The standard places the burden upon the state to show that the statute is supported by a compelling state interest in the least restrictive manner possible. And the state just simply cannot meet the burden in this case. Similarly situated parents who have their parental rights terminated by a trial court are treated differently based upon which judicial district they live in. Essentially, their rights are affected by what zip code they live in. In the 19th Judicial District, for example, termination of parental rights cases are well down the list of priority of cases where court reporters are provided for cases. Of course, after criminal cases. But even after criminal motions hearings and water court hearings have priority in receiving court reporters in juvenile cases and termination of parental rights hearings over the termination hearings.
Counsel, do we have that information in the record concerning the priority that the 19th Judicial District gives to different types of cases?
The appellee referenced that as Administrative Order 0305 as published by the Weld County or the 19th Judicial District.
Thank you.
And in contrast, the 20th Judicial District, the hearings are given priority for termination of parental rights after even civil jury trials. However, they end up third on the list of priority. First criminal trials, then civil jury trials, then termination of parental rights proceedings. And that's Administrative Order 03109. And then in the 13th Judicial District, Denver Juvenile Court, for example, there's always a court reporter available. And the distinction between classes of people, whether created by a statute or a rule, must have some relevant for the purpose for which the classification is made. So here we have two classes of parents, those that have access to court reporters and those that don't. It's just simply an accident of geography.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Lucas, but if I understand correctly, we've addressed this twice before. Two panels of this court have addressed this argument before. Can you distinguish those cases here, or can you tell me why those cases were wrongly decided?
In those cases, counsel had access to at least a draft transcript. They were in jurisdictions, such as the TD case, where there was a draft. It's one of the jurisdictions where there is, for example, a court reporter present at a termination hearing. There was a draft transcript. Far from ideal, but it gives something to appellate counsel to be able to argue the case. And parents whose trial counsel are not appellate counsel, which is frequent in the state of Colorado, should not be burdened by their individual trial counsel's ability to take copious notes during litigation and should try to prep an appellate counsel to be able to take the case on appeal. The remedy here would be to require either expedited transcripts or require that there be a court reporter or require that a dirty transcript be made in a timely manner in order to have it to prepare the notice of or the petition on appeal.
Counselor, but didn't the AJ case give us some other options? You know, the court specifically, or the division of this court specifically said in that case that, you know, appellate courts, including this court, can extend or suspend the deadlines based on showing a good cause, and, you know, potentially the unavailability of a record would be a good cause to extend those deadlines. So why doesn't that offer an appropriate or a partial solution?
In this case, we asked for an extension of the deadlines because the transcript had not been received, even at the time that the petition on appeal was due, and noted that it would not be due even for more than the additional week that the court grants, but we received an order that we could have a one-week extension with no further extensions granted. And that was the order of this court.
Ms. Lucas, that brings me to my question. I think you're raising both an equal protection and a due process challenge. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And for both of those, doesn't your client, as kind of a threshold standing matter, have to demonstrate an actual injury in fact before your client can actually raise this challenge?
Upon review of the transcript, my client does have an additional claim that she would like to bring, and that is an effective assistance of counsel claim. Based on the testimony of the expert, the parent-child interactional evaluator, Dr. Gardner.
And did she seek then to supplement her petition on appeal? Now, you were talking about a one-week extension.
Right.
Was that extension granted to allow you to supplement the petition after availability of the transcripts?
It did not, not specifically order that. And this court set this for oral argument before a supplement could be filed.
Thank you.
This, in this case, she would argue that there was ineffective assistance of counsel based on the counsel's failure to object and seek exclusion of testimony from Dr. Gardner about theories about the minor child CW about his alleged condition of attachment disorder. Dr. Gardner testified that he had not evaluated the child, that this was just a theory, yet there was no objection to that being included. And then that was something that the trial court heavily relied upon in its decision. And that would be reversible error had the court not done that. It would certainly remove many of the impediments that the court found with respect to less drastic alternative in terms of what the court believed the child's condition to be based upon these theories. It certainly did not even rise to the minimum standard of a Daubert challenge, looking at whether there was any sort of reliability or knowing that the opinions offered by Dr. Gardner, given that he testified he never evaluated this child, he was just estimating that this, he was guessing that this was happening, even including speculating that the child could potentially have criminal actions as an adult, something specifically cited by the trial court in its order, was reversible error. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for Ms. Gukin.
Good morning. Jill Gook, and my registration number is 41197. I am counsel for respondent appellate BPW, and may it please the court. I would like to focus why BPW raised three issues for review in our brief. I would like to focus my argument on the third issue that was raised, where we believe the court abused its discretion when it did not find that there was no less drastic alternatives to termination to BPW's child, CJW. I believe in this case the court terminated because they felt that the kinship special respondents were older, they had health issues, and couldn't meet the needs of CJW. However, this is not supported in the record. As the court's aware, at the time of the filing of the brief, I did not have the transcript to the trial, but since that time I have obtained that and would like to bring the court's attention to some testimony that I believe supports that these special respondents were an alternative, particularly for CJW. As the court's aware, that BPW's child remained with a biological mother until March of 2013, at which time the department took custody of CJW and his sister, NMH, who was not a child of BPW. Those children were placed in the home of CJW's paternal grandmother and step-grandfather, and they were the ones that were made special respondents. I think it should be noted, throughout the posture of this case, these two children remained in the special respondent's home. This was not only the recommendation of the department, but the order of the court beginning on April 23rd, when an unopposed motion to grant custody to the special respondents was filed. And this was recommended by the department and affirmed again on June 27th, October 11th, November 8th. It continued to remain the best placement for these children through the termination. And even as of this year, May 1st, the children remain there, and it's still recommended that they are staying in this home. So the issues that I have with the judge's findings that he did not believe this was a good alternative were based mainly on what he felt were the medical challenges of the special respondents, in particular the grandmother, who had a couple hospitalizations. However, she testified at trial that while she does have OCD, she takes medication for it, and it is completely under control.
Ms. Gookin, there was also, I believe, somewhere in the record, a statement that the child, CJW, himself had special needs. Was there any testimony indicating that the grandparents would be able to meet those special needs?
Yes, there was, absolutely. I believe the biggest concern about CJW was his ADHD. The step-grandfather, the special respondent, had a child that had that, so had experience for taking care of a child with that. And I would like the court to note that it was actually the special respondent grandmother that initially recognized this, took him to the doctor, and obtained medication for him for that. She also did testify when asked if the children remain long-term, what she would do for his care. She agreed she would continue to take him to therapy and make sure that was taken care of, and monitor his medication. So I believe that there was no evidence to show that that they would not be able to do this. And in regards to her medical challenges, and I'm almost out of time, but I did want to make one quick note that the judge in this case referenced in his findings, facts, and conclusions, he made reference to the special respondent's mother's health issues and her weight, and how he believed that was an issue, and that was never offered into the record. It was never presented as evidence, anything regarding her weight and any health issues related to it. I think it was just a bias on the judge's part, on an observation that he made. At no time, there was never any evidence presented about any health issues with her, and I'm out of time, so thank you.
Your side of the courtroom has a minute 55.
Good morning, may it please the court. David Skarka, registration number 40811, on behalf of the Weld County Department of Human Services, the petitioner appellee. I will address the constitutional issues, and the guardian ad litem will address the sufficiency of the evidence and the less drastic alternative issue for the court. ALH has not shown an injury to her appellate rights by complying with Rule 3.4. Accordingly, she does not have standing to assert an as applied due process and equal protection challenge to the rule. when a claimant doesn't have an actual injury from an alleged constitutional defect, then there is no clear and inescapable necessity for this court to address a constitutional challenge. This court, divisions of this court, in published cases addressing due process and equal protection challenges, either to Rule 3.4 or to other provisions of the Children's Code, have consistently required claimants to show an injury in fact to establish standing. The issue before the court is very similar to NAT, recorded at 134 P3rd 535 from 2006. But the court in that case didn't have record before it that the mother even had access to a draft transcript. It was unclear whether she had access to that transcript, but what the court emphasized was that the official transcript has, quote, long since been available for review, but mother has at no time attempted to amend the issues raised in her petition or urge new grounds for reversal. Finding that to be the case, the court noted that the requirement of standing and found that the mother in that case hadn't shown an actual injury to her appellate rights.
Mr. Scargan, not to get ahead of you, but NAT involved only a due process challenge.
Yes.
Are you aware of any appellate decision that has addressed an equal protection challenge on the theory asserted here, namely that people in different counties are similarly situated?
Not to Rule 3.4, but to the EPP statute. Okay. And that was an additional citation I supplied the court with, People in the Interest of RJA. In that case, the appellant mother claimed that being subject to the EPP timeframes, which was shortened her time to comply with the treatment plan, subjected her to disparate treatment from those similarly situated in other counties who presumably had more time to comply with their treatment plan. The court reviewed the record and didn't find any evidence that if she had been given additional time, she would have become a fit parent, or that if the case arose in a different county, that county would have given her additional time. Therefore, she hadn't shown that she suffered any injury and didn't have standing to assert an equal protection challenge to the application of the EPP statute. I think it's 19-1-123. That's a similar case I have found on that issue, Your Honor. If we are to assume that standing is not an issue for this court and to address the merits of Rule 3.4 as applied, this court in People X Rel TD did take the opportunity to discuss the constitutionality of Rule 3.4 in that case and found that the parent's interest, private interest, was counterbalanced by the state's, what it described as both significant and compelling interest in speedy and permanent disposition of children who had been adjudicated dependent and neglected. That left the court to consider the risk of an erroneous deprivation of appellate rights. The court was not convinced that there was a risk of an erroneous deprivation of appellate rights because of the flexibility built into the rule. The court acknowledged occasions where, when the petition is due, the record will be incomplete. But the rule is flexible to provide an opportunity for the petition or response to be supplemented after the complete record is available. It further noted that divisions of this court conducted de novo review of the record and can notice issues on its own and request supplemental briefing. Taken together, there was sufficient safeguards to provide a parent their due process right to appeal. The court also noted that the right to appeal was the right issue in that case, noting that at the trial court level, they are afforded all the panoply of due process rights and procedures to protect their fundamental liberty interests in the care, management, and control of their children. If we were to address the equal protection issue on the merits, ALH asserts that this court should apply a strict scrutiny level of review because, according to ALH, the protected interest is the parent's fundamental right in care and custody of their children. But again, the right that we're dealing with here is the statutory right to appeal. That's not a constitutional right. It's not a fundamental right. and laws are presumed to be constitutional, and therefore we apply a rational basis review of Rule 3.4, requiring that the law be rationally related to a legitimate government interest. And this court in TD described the government's interest as both significant and compelling. ALH has not shown in her petition on appeal that Rule 3.4 doesn't serve that interest. The flexibility in the rule is designed to expedite this appeal process so that even when the record is incomplete, when the original petition is filed, there's an opportunity to supplement it. But what is important is that we stick to the deadlines of filing the petition, filing the response, and setting the case for disposition in this court. And that serves the government's compelling interest in providing a speedy and permanent disposition for children adjudicated to be dependent and neglected. Unless there are other questions from the court, I will ask the court to find that ALH has not shown an actual injury to her appellate rights by complying with Rule 3.4 and to affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mary Camp, guardian ad litem for both the trial court and for this appeal court. My number is 33020, and I believe I'm going to have to skip around given the argument of Ms. Gookin a little bit. I also would like to address the less drastic issue, and in particular concerning BW. So as this court is well aware, MN 726 P3D 1108 is a seminal case about less drastic. And there have been many cases since that, but it's been well settled that if the trial court meets the criteria for termination, that is sufficient for less drastic as long as they've taken into consideration the needs of the children. And I would submit that in this case, the trial court did that. In fact, he did it above and beyond. In this case, we had written closing arguments. We had counsel submitting cases. And the trial court took at least 4 to 5 weeks to make his decision. When he made his decision, he submitted the article findings, conclusions, and decision in support of the order. And that is in the court file at 757 to 774. And it is very thorough as far as the trial court weaving his impressions with also the testimony and the exhibits that were given. I was very impressed by that. I was a little worried when we had this judge as he was visiting, and he said his experience was criminal. But when I saw the order that he wrote, I was very impressed that he indeed did consider many, many things that sometimes are omitted just because of the speed of coming to a decision. So I believe that it is well documented, the quotes that he used, both from Dr. Gardner, the caseworker, Nancy Brex, and I will not take the time to go into those, but I would encourage, if you have not, encourage you to read Dr. Gardner's parent-child interactional and then the caseworker's termination letter. She gave a very thorough analysis of whether the parents complied with the treatment plan or not.
Counsel, as long as you raise that point, would you address something that the father's counsel said in their brief, which I think is a really good point, that there was only a 28-day gap between adoption of the amended plan, I don't know if it's both mother or father's, but certainly father's amended treatment plan, and the filing of the motion to terminate. I mean, 28 days, shouldn't the court have allowed more time so that the father could show compliance with the terms and conditions of that amended plan?
Well, first of all, as you know, the father had been absent for 9 months. This was an EPP case that was up in January. To file in November, typically cases take 3 to 4 months to be scheduled. And so certainly he had those 3 to 4 months to prove what needed to be proven. And at any time, the county can withdraw a motion for termination if they feel like the parent is stepping up, and that has happened.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I do want to jump to the grandparents and that less drastic alternative, excuse me. And in his document again, at pages 770 to 773, I believe the judge had numerous reasons. I believe in my reading of it that he was more concerned about their minimization of the children's, in this particular Connor's CW's difficulties, that either they minimized or they were oblivious to it, and that they really did not recognize the scope of what that meant. He also was concerned that this would leave the children open to visits by the parents, which he had concerns about. He did mention the health and the age. Oh, I'm so sorry. And that was his observations, and a trial court is able to do that and should do that. And there were definitely observations about health and age that were readily observable to anybody. So these were two children that were with them that were very demanding. And I believe he was appropriate, as was the caseworker in her termination letter, that these grandparents were fine and should be grandparents to these children, not the parents who would be raising them, that they did not have that ability to do that. Also, the trial judge had a portion called the applicable legal principles that he used. And again, he cited many, many of the cases that are very appropriate here. And in particular for the grandparent issue, he cited MH 855 P2D 15, which states that placement with a grandparent is not a viable alternative to termination if the grandparents lack appreciation of the parent's problems or of the needs of the children. I think the other issue that I wanted to cover quickly has to do with Dr. Gardner's observations. He was an expert. He's allowed to give an opinion. He testified and he submitted his parent-child interactional. A parent-child interactional, by its purpose, is to observe the interactions between parents and children and make comments on whether they are healthy or not. If you look in the record, there was quite a discussion about some changes in the field of psychology about how you're labeling attachment, and that was sort of in there. It used to be a pretty strict thing, and they've changed it. So some of us were using the old terms and some of the new terms. But Dr. Gardner, by the status of his expertise, certainly had, I believe, the right, and it was appropriate for him to speculate on what his observations mean for this child. And both he and the supervisor, Nancy Brex, were very specific about the problems that CW had. Nancy Brex, I think in her testimony, page 15, called him a broken child. So I believe that the record supports the fact that these grandparents are not a less drastic alternative for these children. So I would ask you to affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Lucas, you've got a minute and 53 seconds.
First, with respect to the due process challenge, I would also point the court to the dissent in the RJA case. I'd also point the court to the Supreme Court case, MLB, which was also supplemental authority by the appellee. In that case, the court also found, even though if there's a constitutional right, and the court, this court found in the TD case, well, even if the right to appeal is statutory, the constitutional protections still remain. With respect to less drastic alternatives and Dr. Gardner, even all testimony, even expert testimony, must still meet the reliability standards under the Daubert decision from the Supreme Court. And simple speculation when he has not evaluated a child, when it hasn't been addressed by the court, is still error when the court admitted that evidence, considered that evidence, and relied upon that evidence in granting termination. With respect to Mr. CW, or with respect to CW, the testimony was very different. And first of all, Dr. Gardner didn't observe him in his home with the special respondents, nor did he observe him with his father. And Ms. Brex testified that CW was a very different child when he was with his father. So the affect that they were seeing with Ms. ALH may have been a function of her parenting with that child, and it certainly was not reflective, and nobody contradicted the evidence of what they saw with CW and his father. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your oral arguments very much, as do we appreciate your briefs. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel, safe journey home.